This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, feelers, connectors, relators, friends, and lovers. I'm here in the intimacy of the Right Minded podcast with my co-host, Brooke Warner, and we're here today to talk about The Art of Intimacy and a book titled The Art of Intimacy by the novelist Stacey Durasmo. The Art of Intimacy is part of Grey Wolf's series of Art of books on different writing topics. And we also had on Peter Ho Davies a while back, who wrote The Art of Revision. And I have to say, I've read, I think, almost the entire series, and I just love these books.
It's a wonderful series, too, because the books are so short. So they're almost like long essays, and they approach writing craft from different and sometimes unlikely angles. And I'm excited to have Stacey on with us today.
Yeah, it's the unlikely angles that interest me the most. And on that note, I should tell listeners that we're not necessarily here to talk about the racy kind of intimacy, in case you tuned in for that. And, we're going to talk about the varieties of intimacy that can occur between characters and between reader and story. You know, the spaces in between, as Stacey put it. And she just has so many fascinating things to mention about intimacy in general. And you know, Brooke, when I think of what I like to read and why, I think I read primarily for intimacy, you know, that kinship and closeness I feel for certain characters, but also the kinship I feel toward authors who carry it off on the page. And I'm not sure if I can explain how they carry it off or why I react to their prose in such a way, but I know if I don't feel an intimacy with the story, then no matter how exciting the plot or how strong the other elements are, it won't move me in the ways I want to be moved by writing. And when I go through my list of favorite writers in the last 10 years or so, you know, I think of authors like Rachel Cusk and Teju Cole and Sigrid Nunez and Ocean Vuong, and they're all poetic writers, but it's not just their poetry that draws me, you know, like I literally feel our souls connect when I read them. And I feel like we share something deep, which I might not even share with friends and family. And maybe that's why I don't even want to meet them in person. I just want to have that intimate connection with them on the page. So I'm curious about you, Brooke. Do you find that you read for intimacy or make it as much of a priority as I do? And what authors do you feel an especially intimate connection with?
That's a beautiful sentiment, Grant. I've felt that for sure. And I don't know that I had really given that much thought to reading for it, but I recognize it and I love it when I find it. And I definitely know what you mean, that maybe it's better not to meet those people. It's funny that you mentioned Rachel Cusk, because she's a great example. I felt that way about her writing too. But then when I interviewed her on stage for Women Lit, which is a local series connected to the Bay Area Book Festival, she was a very difficult interview subject. It wasn't like I felt this automatic spark of connection with her. I found her to be very cerebral. I mean, I love her work and she was wonderful, but it was just not like that connection that I might have with her words. So of course you can feel more connected to people through what they write than you would in real life. And I've had those moments of connection with countless writers in their books over the years. I think it's what makes us lifelong fans of certain authors' work, and why, you know, as is the case with our favorite singers or actors, we really feel like we know them, that somehow they're ours. And I felt this way for the first time in my early reading life with Toni Morrison, for sure. I discovered her when I was a college freshman, in some female literature class that I was taking, and they assigned Sula, and I promptly read everything I could get my hands on. And I felt this way with Dani Shapiro. And then, funny enough, I mean, I've also met her several times, and I've had that same experience where I just had a better connection to Dani through her words. But of course, right? Because she's opening up in this very honest way. You have this insight into them, and then you feel like you know them, and then you have interactions with them in real life, and you're like, oh, it's not exactly the same. But of course, I've been in this super privileged position to get to meet a lot of my literary heroes. And I think, you know, the intimacy that you're talking about is actually preserved by not knowing them. Hmm. So I would say, you know, in addition to Morrison, I felt this way about Virginia Woolf, no chance of ever meeting her. And with my recent Annie Ernaux reading spree. So, you know, certain authors take you there and it's an intimacy and a depth and a perspective. So I appreciate you naming it.
Yeah, well, one thing I like about the art of intimacy is how it expands the notion of intimacy beyond the conventional, you know, romantic or sexual connotations of the world. And Stacey explores these different types of intimacy through novels that she examines, which really helps me understand how the author accomplishes that on the page. And so for example, she goes deep into Percival Everett's The Water Cure, which is a novel written in a fragmentary style about a writer's torture of another man. And it's interesting because Stacey posits that we become party through the gaps in the narrative to his crime, and we become intimate with his violence, in short, which is interesting to think about. And actually, like, it made me think of a time in real life when I was mugged at gunpoint. And one of the strangest parts of this experience was something I didn't expect at all, is how an act of violence can create intimacy. Mm-hmm. And because of this, I feel like I'm connected forever to the two guys who held me up, you know, to the extent that I often think of them. And I often wonder how they're doing or what they think of this odd experience we shared. And find myself even strangely caring for them, you know, all because we shared this intense, precarious, dangerous moment. And then another type of intimacy she plumbs is the intimacy of regret or guilt. And she explores this through William Maxwell's novel, So Long, See You Tomorrow. And in Maxwell's book, the narrator imagines the story of a childhood acquaintance whose father has killed his wife and then himself. And years after these events, the narrator sees the other boy at school, and he fails to say hello to him as they pass each other in the hall. So obviously that's not a big deal, of course, except that slight, you know, kind of plays this larger and larger, you know, role in the narrator's mind. And the book becomes a kind of, you know, reparation for this failure of empathy. And the story he imagines, in other words, is the novel we read. And it fills the space in between the two boys. And this is crucial to Stacey's notion of intimacy, because intimacy is the space in between people. And yeah, again, reading her analysis, it made me think of a really similar real experience that I had of being, you know, I was unnecessarily mean to a friend of mine in second grade, and he moved away. And like the narrator of So Long, See You Tomorrow, I carried this guilt and regret with me for years, you know, and I became a little bit obsessed about it. And I finally found this person on social media and apologized. And of course, he said he didn't remember anything. He only had fond feelings for our friendship. But, you know, it just made me think about how we create intimacy in these spaces in between we experience with people, and how we need stories to essentially illustrate our lives for us so that we can understand them. So I'm curious, Brooke, are there any books that have illustrated or evoked surprising or different kinds of intimacy for you, especially on a personal level like this?
Yeah. And before I say anything, I do just want to say, like, you either have an empathy or a guilt complex or both. It's such a sweet story. He's like, I don't care, I'm good. But, you know, it also shows how much we carry things around inside of us, you know, and exactly. If we can let them out. Yeah. Sometimes that's for the better. But, you know, yes, you asked, like, do I have some things on a personal level like this? Certainly more recent ones are memoirs. Obviously because of my love for memoir, but because I've been doing my own writing. I'm sure I've said this on the podcast before. Many of my students know this. I was deeply inspired by Maggie Smith's You Could Make This Place Beautiful. Of course, we had her on the show relatively recently. And her impact on my memoir was profound because it caused me to throw out the 30,000 words that I had in progress and start over. So that's kind of a big deal. Mm. We talked about aesthetic, remember? And I was like, I love her aesthetic. And I think that was part of what I was doing. Like, I don't like what I'm doing, so I'm going to start over. And then Carmen Maria Machado's In the Dream House has impacted me similarly. Stephanie Foo's What My Bones Know, Gina Frangello's Blow Your House Down, and Chantel Miller's Know My Name. Mm. All of those memoirs are sharing deep intimacies. They're pulling back the layers on complexities and traumas, but doing so in such a way that is intimate, you know, what we're talking about today. And that really inspires me. It inspires my writing. And they're also the books that are the benchmark in my own writing, you know, and writers that really move me.
Well, one intimacy is our relationship to ourselves as artists, which Stacy goes into in a different book, her book that's coming out this July. It's called The Long Run. And I love this book. I read an early copy of it. And I love it because she profiles older artists that she admires to find out how they've done it, you know, how they've made art over the course of a lifetime. And it's a topic I haven't seen covered in this way, you know, at the end of artists' creative journeys rather than at an earlier peak. But maybe then the end is the peak, you know, it just kind of depends. But she talked to Valda Setterfield about her 60-year career that took her from the Merce Cunningham Dance Company to theatrical collaborations with her husband to roles in films. And she talked to Samuel Delaney about his vast oeuvre of books, you know, that crossed many genres, and then the intensities of his desires in his real life. I love that chapter. And she talked to Amy Sillman about working between painting and other media and between abstraction and figuration. And she talked to landscape architect Daryl Morrison, composer Tanya Leon, and then actress Blair Brown and the musician Steve Earle. I loved those chapters as well. And she weaves, you know, what was interesting, she weaves these stories into her own creative journey as well. So you're getting a flavor of, it's a type of memoir, I guess.
Well, I appreciate that you took on the vast majority of this reading, and thank you for turning me on to the Blair Brown piece, though, because I loved how she talked about aging women doing their art, definitely up my alley. And aging and art are particularly challenging for women who are performers and actresses, of course. And Stacy says in the book, it takes one kind of shamelessness to show up on camera naked when you're 33. It takes an entirely different strain of shamelessness to show up on camera with your natural face in your 70s. And in the interview, we're going to talk a bit about Jodie Foster. I mean, there really is a whole wave of women who are doing this so much better. I'm in the middle of watching Feud, Grant, and all of the women in that show are 50 plus for sure, you know, in their 60s. And it's just a wonderful thing to see these women, you know, looking very much their age. And it's just interesting because we don't talk about that as a shamelessness, but Stacy really does trace it to the urgency artists feel for their art. And, and I think there's something really beautiful here, you know, which is that people are, they're modeling it. And so then you see more women artists modeling that, you know, kind of showing their age out there in the world. You know, it's interesting because I think the more aging women who model that for other aging women, you know, the more normal it becomes. And perhaps then we're all flaunting that level of shamelessness in the very best way.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I recently read a survey that actually said people were generally happier in their 60s than their 50s. And that applied to women in particular. And the angle was that people left behind a lot of their hangups about their looks or how other people perceived or judged them. And they were just more comfortable in their skin, you know, literally and figuratively. So aging was a type of liberation. You know, they had no fucks to give, in other words. And I think we're in an era in our culture when we're seeing new possibilities in aging. So I like the idea of exploring aging as something that can actually enhance creativity, you know, simply because we can be shameless, which I think is a trait to cultivate.
Agreed, Grant. You know, obviously, we have a lot of authors who are on the older side at She Writes Press, and they're constantly inspiring me with their perseverance and their refusal to be boxed in. And, you know, this boomer cohort, they have been a generation to change the way that things are done from early days, and they are laying a nice groundwork for the rest of us when it comes to creativity and reinvention. So excited to talk to Stacy about this book, her original book, Art of Intimacy, and the new book that's coming out, and much more. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this break.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm excited to introduce Stacey DeRasmo, one of my favorite authors. She's the author of 5 novels and now 2 books of nonfiction. Her first novel, Tea, was selected as a New York Times notable book. Her second novel, A Seahorse Year, was named a best book of the year by the San Francisco Chronicle and Newsday and won both a Lambda Literary Award. Her third novel, The Sky Below, was a favorite book of the year for the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Sun-Times, and the New York Times. And her fourth novel, Wonderland, was named one of the 10 best books of the year by Time and the BBC, and was also among NPR's best books of 2014. Today, we're going to talk about her nonfiction book, The Art of Intimacy, The Space Between, and also her upcoming book of essays, The Long Run. Welcome, Stacey.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you. And I want to start by mentioning the E.M. Forster quote that you include in The Art of Intimacy, his infamous entreaty to only connect. And that sounds simple, and yet it's a big question of how to connect in the space, you know, in the space in between, as you put it. I love thinking about that space in between. And one thing I loved about your book was the expansion of the word intimacy, you know, is not just something romantic or sexual. So Brooke and I were talking about different types of intimacies we've experienced in life and in reading before you came on. So I was wondering if we could start by you telling us more about your definition of intimacy and why you wanted to write about intimacy.
Well, I'm going to answer the second part first, which is that I wanted to write about creating a sense of intimacy in fiction, A, because it was something that I certainly struggled with as a writer, was sort of how to do that. And I was very, very curious about how it was that other writers, you know, whom I admired, how they actually did this. And as I read and thought a lot about these other writers, what I definitely found was that it was a much, much stranger and much more technical and oblique than the way that we experience it as readers, right? Two characters standing around saying like, "I love you." "No, I love you more." "Oh, we love each other so much. Kiss, kiss, kiss," right? Is completely kind of dead on the page, pretty much, right? It doesn't really sort of do anything. And so I was very interested in kind of getting at how other folks had done this. And my definition of intimacy, certainly, there's a galaxy of intimacies, right? I mean, and all of these need to be alive on the page. That's what we try to do as writers. But there are so many, I mean, sometimes I think about all the odd moments of touch with strangers, like the person who washes your hair when you go to get your haircut, the person who gives you change at the grocery store. You know, I live here in New York, so someone might brush past you on the train. There are a million sort of very ephemeral, liminal moments where we are connected to other people, right? And certainly, I mean, The Art of Intimacy was 2013, but if I was going to revisit it, you know, obviously in the kind of incredibly immersive online experience that we all live in now, I mean, there should be like a whole other volume on those intimacies, which are often profound. And the sense of how do you render that kind of intimacy on the page as a writer is actually very, very difficult. Folks, you know, have tried to get that on the page, but only say like a page of text messages, right? That doesn't quite get at the weird way that it feels. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Patricia Lockwood's novel, No One Is Talking About This, to me kind of got at something about the way the internet feels. Anyway, so in those ways, the kinds of intimacies that are available to us as modern people are actually only expanding, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and Stacey, you write that one of the dangers of writing about intimacy is that the writing can be sentimental, where the emotions are, you write, slathered thickly. And it made me think about something Dave Eggers said about the word sentimental being used disparagingly by critics often. And yet to feel sentimental, you know, is maybe how we access emotion. So I was wondering how you go about advising writers of writing about intimacies in its complexities rather than its slatherings.
I'll agree with my colleague Dave Eggers in the sense that like sentiment, we are sentient beings. We feel sentiment, right? And sometimes sentimentality has certainly been that charge has certainly been used against, like, say, women writers to say, like, well, you know, because the character of the mother wept over the death of her child, this was sentiment, right? So one thing is that if you think about the word intimacy, we often immediately think of something positive, like, you know, love, friendship, affinity, these positive ways of closeness. But obviously, there are also myriad destructive intimacies, rage-filled intimacies. If you punch someone in the face, that is an intimacy, right? So, you know, one thing that often happens when we're coming to the page is that we want to protect our characters. And this is true of me too. You know, it's like, ooh, I just wanted to be nice for them and to work out and to not kind of dig down into both the, maybe the lovely sides and the not so lovely sides of an intense intimacy, which is true in any relationship that we have, right? I mean, a relationship with a partner, we do our best, right? But in any real long-term relationship, there's conflict, there's projection, there's unfairness, there's crabbiness, right? I mean, all of these things are always in there. And so you really want to kind of stay alive to the sort of three-dimensional emotional world. And it's difficult. It's really quite difficult. And, you know, one of the things that I was talking about in the book is the way that, especially in modern life or modern Western life, there's a way in which the kind of positive intimate relationship is the way that we try to hold everything together, right? Like, not God, not patriotism, not the great chain of being or something, but it's like, okay, well, if we can get everybody sorted into a meaningful dyad, then everything works out, and that's the explanation for everything. And, you know, it isn't.
Well, Stacey, you know, while reading your book, it made me think about how I read primarily for intimacy, I think, as opposed to, say, plot or other kinds of craft elements. And I definitely write with intimacy strongly in mind, but I haven't deconstructed, like, how I'm writing with a sense of intimacy. And I don't even know how consciously I'm thinking about that as I'm writing. And I know I'm not really thinking of, you know, techniques to achieve it, but I was wondering, since you mentioned that you were challenged to write with intimacy on the page, I was wondering how you think about creating intimacy in your own work.
That's a really good question. Well, for one thing, right, I mean, I do believe the kind of writing adage that if the writer isn't feeling it, the reader isn't feeling it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one thing that I definitely learned from studying these other folks and how they create a sense of intimacy on the page is that actually the way they're doing it very often, in ways that we find meaningful or that I find meaningful, is that they create a real atmosphere around the characters. There's a whole, not just setting, right, but in fact, the very language that they're using to create the scene, right? And not just narrative tension, like, you know, are the lovers separated by a boulder or, you know, whatever it is, right? That they're creating this kind of mood, this kind of atmosphere. And I think that taught me that is really, in a way, you're bringing the reader almost into the felt experience of the intimacy before and around the characters. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, there's a part from Wolf's book to the lighthouse where all these characters are sitting having dinner. And it's very beautiful. But the way that she describes the room, the light, what they're looking at, there's a line in there that I think is so incredibly beautiful, which is it says, but looking together united them, right? This feeling that these characters are all looking at the same, it's this bowl of fruit. And so I'm now less anxious about what are the characters saying and doing, and more interested in can I create a kind of an atmosphere on the page that seduces the readers. The characters can take care of themselves. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're fine. They're like ready to fall in love or hate each other or merge identities or whatever. My job, any of our job, is to kind of woo the reader. And so I'm much more aware of that now. Much more aware of that. And, you know, I'll return to Forrester, actually, who one of the things that he says about character that I think is so wonderful is he says, in aspects of the novel, he says, when we read fiction, we feel that we have access to a character's inner life, their kind of secret life, to an extent that we will never, ever be able to feel with an actual person. Right? That's part of what we read for. Like when you say like this feeling of intimacy, right? There's the feeling of intimacy with the writer's mind, but there's also that wonderful feeling with the character of like, oh my God, I get this person entirely in a way that even with the people that you're closest to in life, Forrester says, we can't get that close. And we come to books to have that kind of experience. So, and when books do that, it's wonderful.
Well, and Grant and I were saying in the banter that sometimes you don't even feel that way toward the authors themselves, right? I mean, that we can have an intimacy with an author, but then when we meet them in real life, there's a distance, you know, they're not necessarily who you think they are. So it's a fascinating way that words let you in, of course. So,
yeah.
Well, thank you.
They're never who you think they are.
You're living up to expectations, Stacey, just so you know.
Oh, good. Well, that's nice.
Well, switching subjects, because we want to ask you about your new book, The Long Run, coming out in July. Why did you want to answer the question of how people create in the long run?
You know, I had written a few novels, and I started thinking about like, well, how do I keep doing this? I wanted was to keep doing this, but you know how it is, right? That it takes so much in what we do to get to book one. I mean, for most people, not everyone, but for most people, just getting that first book is everything. It's everything. And one puts so much into it. And there's a lot of sort of writing and sort of thoughts about that, about the very young writer or artist. But then we go along, right? And you understand that one needs to sustain oneself in all senses for years, right? And so I got curious. I thought, okay, well, how does one keep doing this? And so I started kind of looking around, right? I started kind of like asking people this a little bit, thinking about it. But then actually what happened was, and I talk about this in the book, a number of things in my life kind of came apart. And then I really, really wanted to know. And it was no longer sort of, let's ponder this interesting question, but much closer to like, oh, wow. Now what? Right. So what I decided to do was to actually go and interview people who are alive and working now and who were significantly older than I was, to actually ask them that question and see what they would say. And I knew that no one can actually answer that question straight up, but I was very interested in what their response would be and what I would find out in talking to them. And it was very important to me to talk to, as I said, just talk to people who are alive now, because you can look back at someone's life, right? And, you know, like there's a big Martha Graham biography that just came out that I'd like to read, but, you know, she's been gone a long time. And it seems as if the, you know, the circle is closed. It's over. But folks living and working now who certainly don't feel that it's over, that's who I really wanted to talk to.
Well, Stacey, you mentioned about how your own life was had a certain trajectory while you were writing this.
Yeah.
And I actually loved the essays because of the way that you wove in your own creative journey and your own life to the point that, you know, it's maybe too much to say it's a type of memoir, but I definitely felt like memoir aspects to it.
Yeah.
And so I was just kind of curious of this intermingling of other people's stories about their long runs and how did their stories maybe affect your own long run or your, whatever the long run of the future?
Sure. I mean, I also decided as I ventured into the book, I thought, you know, I don't want to play it safe. If I'm going to ask people to answer this unanswerable question, and in many ways, this very intimate question, right? I had to be able to take the risk myself to say something about what my own, you know, run has been. Mm-hmm. And it absolutely, over the years that I was working on the book, to speak to people and hear what they had been through and hear what they had drawn on, it has absolutely affected me because in a number of different ways. I mean, for one thing, maybe it's just me, but we all tend to think that our own story is so unique. You know, our troubles have been such exciting and interesting troubles. And of course, when you go and talk to people, right? I mean, many of the people that I spoke to, what they have gone through in their lives as artists has been far more challenging than anything I've ever been through. I mean, two people in the book, the composer and conductor Tanya Leon and the visual artist and poet Cecilia Vicuña, they were both exiled from their countries, Tanya Leon from Cuba and Cecilia Vicuña from Chile. And they literally found themselves on a dime in stateless and remained both in both cases, they remained stateless for quite some time. So in many ways, it certainly helped me get over myself, right? And I was incredibly moved by the way in which the people in the book, they allowed themselves to be seen with their work and in their work over many, many, many years. And let me see if I can articulate that more clearly. Like, for instance, the actress Blair Brown is someone who I interviewed for the book, who's great. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I found, and she's, you know, she's in her 70s now, and she has worked as an actress all her life, right? But if you want to keep working, let's say, as an actress, and you want to like look like a normal person, right? You have to allow the world to see you and to know you over the entire arc of your life, as opposed to kind of freeze drying yourself and only being wheeled out on special occasions. And the same thing with Volda Setterfield, an amazing postmodern dancer who I spoke to for the book and who's wonderful, who continued to perform over her entire life. But in order to do that, you actually have to let go of certain kinds of shame. And I think that as we get older, I mean, I'm older now, I'm 62. I really began to understand that shame can begin to creep in and to make one more reluctant to be seen either literally or figuratively. And with the people that I spoke to, one of the things that I found really strengthening and wonderful is just that simple quality in them that they were going to continue to let audiences, readers, viewers, et cetera, know them as they are. And I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, I was thinking about Jodie Foster, actually, just because she's someone who's grown up in the public eye, right? And like seeing her is actually really inspiring. She's not trying to not age.
You know, it's really interesting that you would bring her up because I mean, I watched the most recent True Detective, right? Like a lot of people, and I thought she was great. But one of the things that I think is very, very interesting about her is that, yes, she, I mean, looks like that's her whole real face to me, right? but also she has been willing to move with the moment. I mean, one of the things that she said about True Detective is that they had, I think originally it was sort of, her character was kind of the main character. And she said, no, really the other detective, the character played by Kelly Reese, that character needs to come forward as a full, right? This is not a kind of a star vehicle just for her. So she was saying, do not just center me, the white woman, the, you know, star of past decades, but I want to be co-centered with Kelly Reese. And she's moving, right? She's not like building the sort of monumental Jodie Foster.
Yeah, no, that's a great point.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Totally.
And I think that to me is very, very interesting. And the character that she played in that show had a lot of very rough edges, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Just to watch that kind of diversity of capacity, I guess, is interesting to me. It's kind of what you're saying. She's not preserved and she's nimble. I guess it sort of segues into our final question here. You say that the urge to make art no matter what can't be taught and talent can't be taught. And then Amy Silman says in the book, and I'm just going to do a little quote here, which says, I think it's a type of metabolism that drives me to change and change and change my forms, searching rather earnestly for something I don't quite know already, a kind of questioning machine, endlessly discontent. And you mentioned Martha Graham. That phrase, endlessly discontent, reminds me of Graham's divine dissatisfaction. So what do you make of discontentedness as a driving force of creation?
Yeah. I mean, discontentedness is great, right? I mean, in the sense that that feeling of a kind of friction, a kind of productive friction between soul and world, mm-hmm. that you say, no, I need to say it. I need to say it. I need to say it. And each time you're kind of pitching the penny halfway to the wall, right? And never reaching the wall, that feeling of urgency around the expression, I think, is what can't be taught. Although you can, I mean, it's important to say a talent can't be taught and the drive to create can't be taught, but you can squash it. Hmm. And I think that as someone who teaches and anyone who kind of, you know, does any kind of work like that, we have to be on guard not to ever squash that in people. And the other thing that I want to say about that is that it's as someone who teaches, I actually see a lot of talent. I mean, it's as if like if I'm standing at a stream and talent is fish, there's a lot of fish. Mm-hmm. What is harder to come by actually is resilience for the process.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what really takes people out. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure we can all think of folks that it's being able to roll with what happens when you try to put your work in the world, that is the thing that I think is much more, it's often what people really, really need, right? And part of the divine dissatisfaction, right, is that you also have to be able to bear that dissatisfaction. You have to say, no, you know what? I still want to say, and I still want to say, and I still want to say, and not sort of try to, not try to kind of repress that in yourself. It's an alive impulse, right?
It is. Thank you, Stacy. Beautiful words. I appreciate your perspective.
Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely. Loved it, Stacy. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Thank you.
We'll be right back after this short break with today's book trend.
So, Brooke, our conundrum in this week's trend is one that people are going to face for generations to come. What to do with a great writer's work after the writer is given word to have that work destroyed. And one of the most famous instances of this is Franz Kafka, who told his friend Max Brod to destroy his work. And fortunately, Brod didn't, because for one, a young writer named Gabriel Garcia Marquez read Kafka, and Kafka was one of his inspirations to be an author. And now Marquez stated a wish for one of his novels, his last novel, to be destroyed. And that's in question, because his family has actually published this last novel. It's called Until August, and some think they're, you know, not doing it for the quality of the work, but they just want to make some extra cash.
Yeah, so I'll fill everybody in on the story if you haven't heard about it already, which is that Until August was written when Garcia Marquez had dementia, and it's coming out a decade after his death on what would have been his 97th birthday. It's been described by his sons as the fruits of one of the last efforts to carry on creating against all odds, and tells the story of a woman who makes a yearly pilgrimage to her mother's grave on a Caribbean island, a trip that becomes dominated by a series of chance sexual encounters. But as you said, Marquez asked for it to be destroyed because he felt he'd lost the powers to write to the level that he expected of himself. And until now, the manuscript has been available to scholars at the Writers Archive in Texas. But recently, the Garcia Marquez sons made the decision to publish it, as you said, judging it to be far better than their father believed, except that some writers and fans have really taken exception with that and have seen it as a betrayal that endangers Garcia Marquez's legacy.
Well, it's a big question. Fortunately, I don't have to answer this personally because neither my mother or father wrote great novels and asked me to destroy them. but I want to ask you, Brooke, what would you do in this situation if you were Garcia Marquez's daughter?
Yeah, it's funny because as soon as I read the story, that's what I did. I put myself in his son's position, and it took me about 5 seconds to come to the conclusion that I would have done the same thing. Hmm. You know, Garcia Marquez is a legend. He's a once in a generation kind of writer. You know, so it's his iconic status that makes this situation very different than if he had been your mother or father, you know, punching out a few words. And you know, yeah, his family will make some money off of this book, but I think there's something much more important here, which has to do with making works like this accessible. And also, it didn't escape me that Garcia Marquez had dementia at the end of his life, nor should it escape anyone. You know, and it's hard to know what was factoring into his decision making to want to have his work destroyed in the first place. So There's just a lot of layers to this story and to his son's decisions. But I am going to hold your feet to the fire, Grant, and ask you the same question. You know, what would you have done if you were in their shoes?
Yeah, I have to say that, yeah, I think I'd publish it. Perhaps just because I have a hard time destroying any writing. You know, I have stacks of journals and I've typed all of my notes into Word files, and I still can't get rid of them, even though there's no use for them. But I think there's value in publishing it, essentially to make the novel available to everyone, not just scholars with access to his papers in Texas, you know. And a writer in the New York Times wrote that, "We all benefit when works by great artists that are marked for destruction are instead preserved. That's why the way Garcia Marquez's sons have managed their father's legacy, including the publication of Until August, should be praised and perhaps even studied." And who would say that Kafka's works should have been destroyed, you know, at this point? I think we all benefit from them. So, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, the novelist Colin McCann captured it best. He wrote, "What a joy it is to think that there are still things to discover in the world. I would walk 500 miles to get to a new Marquez book. It's like discovering ice at the end of a long journey." Hmm. Marquez is both beloved and necessary, a rare combination in the literary world. Every time you enter a Marquez book, there will be something new, even if you have read it 4 or 5 times. But to come upon a thing for the first time is a rare treat. And I just love that quote so much because I've read 100 Years of Solitude twice and it's just so true. You know, he is a master and this is, in some ways, I felt excited by it. and since my own dad had, you know, some cognitive stuff going on at the end of his life too, I just thought, yeah, I mean, there are other considerations and this really is a gift.
Yeah. The Times article that I mentioned also mentioned that in 1852, the Russian writer Nikolai Gogol burned several manuscripts just days before he died. And among them were the second part of what would have been the trilogy Dead Souls, you know. So we lost that for good, you know.
Yeah. And it's hard. And I think one of the things about that article, the author said, imperfect works of art are more useful than destroyed ones. Mm-hmm. So with that, Grant, here at Right Minded, we are absolutely of the mindset that literature is better imperfect than destroyed. Hear, hear to that. And each week we bring you our own imperfect offerings, and we're grateful that you receive them and share them and that you continue to tune in. So thank you and have a very right-minded week.